When I was initially hired there at Stoneville, 19 years ago, got put on permanent after about a 2-year postdoc, Bill Meredith laid out the challenge for me shortly after, you know, I got put on permanent. Said, Bill, look, see if you can't come up with something that's going to increase the yield of cotton by 10%. I'm going, okay, how long do I have to do this? And to try to approach that challenge that he laid out there for me, I started looking at some of the other cotton growing regions in the U.S., you know, primarily focusing on like California and Arizona, and realizing, you know, they're producing higher yields per acre than what we're getting here with in Mississippi. But so what's really different about those growing environments than what we have in Mississippi? And the first things that came to mind are the obvious things, you know, well, there's less precipitation out there. That can't be it. There are hotter temperatures out there in general. That's probably not it. But there's also more sunlight that's occurring during the growing season than what we have in Mississippi. So that got me to thinking about setting up a series of source-to-sink manipulation experiments where I'm manipulating the assimilate pool that's available to our reproductive growth through various treatments. We conducted this over a series of about 2 or 3 experiments over the years. Here we had put out a 30% shade cloth out on the over the plots to reduce the assimilate supply available to the reproductive structures. We also bent some of the adjoining rows back away from some rows to increase the penetration into the canopy for sunlight. We put some reflectors down in between the rows to reflect sunlight back up off the ground onto the leaves to try to increase the canopy photosynthesis. We did things like, you know, the traditional fruit removal studies where we pulled off all the fruit off of the sympodial branch except for the first position branch. We did a treatment where we removed the subtending leaf to a position one bowl on a sympodial branch here. And we were trying to see what was going on with yield and what was going on with some of these yield components that were involved here, and also what was going on with fiber quality. And to address the fiber quality issue, we did a lot of tagging of first position bowls on the same date so that everything was developing at about the same time period. And through that series of experiments, one thing we found was when we compared the yield of our open canopy treatment where we bent back the adjoining rows to that of our control plot, we've got an increase in lint yield of approximately 17% relative to our control. When we put the reflectors down on the ground, we increased lint yield about 6% relative to our control. And with our shade plot, we got about a 20% decrease in yield here. And so I'm interpreting this data because we were able to increase the yield by increasing the amount of sunlight that was made available to the canopy, that our yields in the Mid-South truly are limited by the amount of sunlight that we receive during the growing season. We also took, as I said, we took a look at some of the fiber quality issues involved with that, and the most obvious and consistent thing that we found was when we put the shade out on the plot, this was a 30% shade, that we decreased the fiber strength in just about every study that we ran with this, and this was roughly about a 6% decrease in fiber strength. You'll also notice that the fiber micronair with the treatments where we increased the source material relative to the seed material, with our partial defruited treatment, we increased the fiber micronair on it. There was also a tendency for the shaded plot to have a numerically lower mic than what we saw with the control. And some of our studies, that was actually statistically different. On this particular one right here, it was not. But that seemed to fit into the idea that, you know, the assimilate supply available to a developing bowl can have an impact on our fiber micronair as well. And following up these fiber quality differences between our shade plot and our control, we extended this to a further study where we were looking at the fiber carbohydrate concentrations at various times after and thesis during fiber development. Specifically, we look at it 14, 21, and 35 days post and thesis. And you'll notice that during our 14 days post and thesis, we found a significantly lower fiber starch concentration than what we did in our control plots. And you also note that with our fiber sucrose concentrations, we found a significantly lower fiber sucrose concentrations at 21 days post-anthesis. Now, if you allow me a little bit of leeway to speculate here, fiber strength is generally thought to be developed during the first 21 days after anthesis here. So, like a little bit of leeway, it's not hard to see that how maybe this reduction in fiber starch during 14 days post-anthesis might be related to the decreases in fiber strength that we're seeing. And there may be a little bit of play there with the sucrose decline under our shade treatment as well. And that sucrose decline may also impact on the decrease in fiber micronair that we're seeing when we are reducing the assimilate supply as well. One of the things that you tend to do when you're starting out a career is kind of fall back on the things that you know. And since I came out of a graduate program that was had a heavy emphasis on gas exchange measurements here, that's what I kind of fell back on. And again, chasing this sunlight limitation to cotton yield, we were looking to see if we could pick out any useful genetic differences in the way that the plants are using that sunlight or their photosynthesis. Here we've got myself here and my technician, Cedric Brown, there using our trusty old LiCor 6200 photosynthesis system, which was I no longer have and many oftentimes wish that I did because it was really a workhorse instrument and gave me a lot of good numbers from it. Here we are in the process of developing some assimilate versus internal carbon dioxide curves here over time here, or the ACI curves as we like to call them. This is Cedric Brown again with my other technician, Tony Miller. They're measuring some dark respiration on some leaves here. This was during the process of generating some light response curves on these plants here. So you can see we've done a lot of things to try to evaluate the photosynthetic potential of leaves of different varieties over time here. And this also includes some of the chlorophyll fluorescence technology that we've been implemented. One of the first studies that we did with this was to look at how various leaf types are impacting the photosynthesis or the carbon dioxide exchange rate, CER. I was in a fortunate position there that I had access to a lot of the germplasm that Bill Meredith has developed over times, and of that he had developed some leaf type isolines, the super ochre leaf, the ochre leaf, and the normal leaf, and these were all in the MD6511 background, and I was able to play around with those a little bit. And you'll notice that in every measurement date that we took, measured our photosynthesis in both years, always the super ochre and the ochre leaf had a higher photosynthetic rate per unit leaf area than did our normal leaf type. Now, we've also included Delta Pine 50 in there as well. Those of you who've been in cotton long enough remember that it was as popular a variety in its day as triple nickel has been the past few years. So that was we included that primarily as a good standard variety to work with. The problem with the ochre leaf and the super ochre leaf is that when grown in our 40-inch row configurations, they don't produce enough overall canopy leaf area to produce enough assimilate to give us the yields that we are accustomed to with our normal leaf type ice lines. Their higher photosynthesis is on a per unit leaf area, on a per square inch basis, if you will. We've also found that while these leaf type isolines were able to give us higher rates of photosynthesis per unit leaf area, they also sometimes exhibited a lower stomatal conductance than did our normal leaf type isolines, which led them to have lower internal carbon dioxide levels than did our normal leaf type. And if you keep extending this further on a gas exchange basis, on an instantaneous basis, these two leaf types would have a higher water use efficiency because they are photosynthesizing at a higher rate but actually transpiring at a lower rate than what the normal leaves were. That's on an instantaneous basis. You know, sometimes that doesn't necessarily always translate to the season-long water use efficiency differences. Following these differences in the photosynthesis up further here, we were able to show that the super ochre and ochre leaf type isolines leaves tended to be thicker with higher specific leaf weights and higher chlorophyll concentrations than did our two normal leaf isolines. And the implication from all this is that with these two smaller leaf type isolines, there appears to be a concentration of the photosynthetic components over a smaller area than what you have with the normal leaf type, and that's what's helping to contribute to this higher photosynthetic rate per unit leaf area relative to our normal. There also generally tends to be, this is a kind of a gross generalization, but there is oftentimes when you're comparing different varieties or genotypes, there's oftentimes a rough positive correlation between specific leaf weights and gas exchange. That's not always the case. There are some notable exceptions to that, but that's kind of a rough approximation of what you can see oftentimes. We also did a study where we were getting away from the leaf types and looking just strictly at normal leaf type cotton varieties. This is a study that I did with Bill Meredith again, and we had 18 different normal leaf type cotton varieties ranging all over from origin, all over from different breeding programs all over the cotton belt here. And we went in and every week we measured photosynthesis on these plants here from about the 10th of July on through the end of August, which is roughly our bowl filling period. And we took those numbers and we averaged them together, which gives us our CER numbers across the bottom. And then we plotted our lint yield that we got out of those plots against that. And you can see that we've got a fairly nice little relationship where we're getting an increase in our lint yield with the increase in average photosynthesis during the bowl filling period here. Now, this would actually be a little bit tighter relationship than what I'm showing if I excluded the point in the lower right-hand side. Don't seem to have a laser pointer up here right quick, but that's an Akela cotton that is not adapted whatsoever to the Mississippi Delta yield-wise, and if we excluded that point, we'd get a much nicer and tighter relationship than what we're having to see there. Now, there you go. That point right there, leave that out. We'd get a nicer relationship. So what this is kind of telling me is that over this period of time with these varieties, as breeders were striving for their increased yields, they were also actually selecting for increased photosynthesis during the bowl filling period. Now, I don't think they realized they were doing this, but it was a fortuitous development. And this is not always the easiest thing to show with single leaf gas exchange measurements, because you're using this to estimate a canopy effect, and you're also using this to estimate a season-long effect. The fact that we took so many measurements and averaged them during the bowl filling period is one of the things I helped us to get this nice relationship here. I also, as I was starting my work, I inherited a potassium fertility study from Earl Minton that he had started in the mid-1980s there at Stoneville. Earl was a plant pathologist, and I quickly shifted the emphasis of the work away from pathology down to physiology, which I was comfortable with here. And one of the first studies that we took on that was looking at how dry matter partitioning was impacted by the two different potassium fertility rates here. The most obvious thing that happens to a potassium deficient canopy is that it's of shorter stature than what you see with the adequately fertilized canopy is. And with that, you get that decrease in plant height, as I'm showing here, and you also get the decrease in leaf area index, which comes about from a reduction in the overall size of individual leaves plus a reduction in the overall number of leaves. With that also, you tend to get an increase in the specific leaf weight of those leaves in our potassium deficient plots here. Now, this is one of these exceptions to the rules where I was talking about how there's often a positive relationship between specific leaf weights and leaf photosynthesis. Here, you know, a potassium deficiency is going to decrease your leaf photosynthesis, but it also increases your specific leaf weight. This is the exception to the rule here. One of the other tools in photosynthesis that we often use is measuring the percent canopy interception of the sunlight that's coming in here. Again, here are my two technicians, Tony Miller and Cedric Brown, measuring some canopy sunlight interception here. And we've used this on our two potassium plots here. This term PPFD, that stands for photosynthetic photon flux densities, which is just a fancy scientific way of saying visible sunlight. So this is canopy sunlight interception percent. And as you can see, as you would expect, with a reduced leaf area index under our potassium deficient conditions, you are actually intercepting less sunlight than with the well potassium fertilized canopy. And we weren't the first ones to publish on this. Owen Guadney, he had a paper out before I did showing that potassium deficient canopies intercept less sunlight than do the adequately fertilized lines. So what you're getting here with your potassium deficiency is you're getting a reduced canopy size that's intercepting less solar radiation. And of that solar radiation that it's intercepting, it's using it less efficiently because there is a reduced photosynthesis per unit leaf area in these potassium deficient canopies as well. So we're presenting a smaller overall assimilate pool to our reproductive growth. Now, Bill Ashley's group in Georgia in the mid-1970s has classically shown that assimilate movement out of a potassium deficient leaf is restricted relative to that under a normal leaf. And we produced some complementary data where we've shown that under our potassium deficient conditions, we get increases in the leaf glucose concentration relative to the well-fertilized plots here. And so this comes back to it. Not only have we got that reduced canopy intercepting less sunlight and using it less efficiently to produce our photoassimilates, of that limited pool already, it's moving less of that pool out of the leaves to the reproductive growth, which even makes a smaller pool available to support that reproductive growth. And as you might expect, when you have all that going against you, a potassium deficient canopy is going to yield less. You know, big shocking statement there. And we found it in this particular study, it yielded about 9% less. And this yield reduction came across all the yield components that we looked at. Potassium deficiency also affects the quality of the fiber produced here. While we didn't see a difference in the 2% span length, our 50% span length and our length uniformity were reduced under the potassium deficient conditions. Now earlier, DeHenza had shown that potassium and malate are the primary osmotica that are driving fiber cell elongation in the cotton plant. And so this makes sense and falls into what they have previously shown here. So the reduced fiber length is expected. Fibromycin is also reduced under potassium deficient conditions, and it comes about both by a reduction in the two components of Micronair, fiber maturity and fiber perimeter. And this fits right into the concept of a reduced overall assimilate supply that's available to the developing bowl that's given us this reduction in fiber maturity, which is closely associated with the deposition of cellulose into the secondary cell wall of the fiber. A reduced assimilate supply means there's less to be converted into cellulose and thereby deposited into the secondary cell wall. So, at least in my way of thinking, it all seemed to make sense. We've also reported a reduction in fiber elongation relative to the fertilized plots. We did not see any difference in fiber strength among our two potassium fertility treatments. Now, other researchers that are doing potassium fertility work, they have reported that a potassium deficiency decreases fiber strength, but I've never seen that in any of the work that I've done on it. One of the things that I've always tried to do during my career is to test my physiological ideas out on field-grown plants, because in my experience, plants grown in the greenhouses oftentimes don't look like and very often don't behave like plants that we see in the field. And so this, as part of that, I've taken some angles of trying to confirm greenhouse studies out in the field. And this is the approach that I've taken with this particular study right here, where we had an irrigated versus a drought stress comparison here. Here we've got black plastic that we put down between the rows to try to minimize the amount of rainfall that was reaching the ground on that particular treatment. And I'm not going to go into the obvious differences like reduced yield under drought stress and shorter fibers under drought stress, and that's pretty well known here. What I'm wanting to focus on is how we found photosynthesis to behave under drought stress. And here we measured our gas exchange on both our droughted and our well-watered plots here, and we measured them on the same leaf both in the morning and in the afternoon. Came back to that same leaf at both times here. Now, classically, we tend to think that drought stress reduces photosynthesis. But on these drought stress plants, these leaves are actually smaller in size, probably because of reduced leaf expansion. They have higher Pacific leaf weights, there's that term again, higher chlorophyll content than did our irrigated plants. And on these deep delta soils that I'm working on, the plants are able to somewhat recharge their hydraulic status overnight, and during the mornings they are able to take advantage of these increased photosynthetic component per unit leaf area and photosynthesize at a higher rate than what our irrigated plants are doing. Now, they're not able to maintain that. As the hydraulic status of the plant continues to deteriorate during time, as you get into the afternoon, that photosynthesis crashes. And we ended up with the classic lower photosynthesis on our drought stress plant relative to our irrigated plants here. We see the same thing with the quantum efficiency of photosystem 2 here, and this was determined with chlorophyll fluorescence. Now, we've shown numerous times here that photosynthesis in the afternoon is always lower than photosynthesis when measured in the morning at similar light intensities. The difference is that with a drought stress plant, it collapses much more significantly than what you're getting with the irrigated plant. And so one of the points that I'm really wanting to make to you guys and to take with you is that if you're contemplating doing a photosynthesis study in cotton, you really need to pay attention as to what time of day you're getting your measurements. Try to get them all either in the morning, preferably, or in the afternoon if you have to. Don't split them between the morning and afternoon, because that will probably impact the results you're trying to get. Chasing after the sunlight limitation again here. We've got an ongoing, we have ongoing studies where we're still continuing trying to look at, look for useful genetic variation for photosynthesis. But that's going to be long-term research, and it's probably going to be high-risk research, and which meaning that I may not be completely successful with that. So in the short term, we were trying to look at this, something else that we could try. And I can't go up there and crank up the intensity of the sun to try to overcome the sunlight limitation we're having here in the Mid-South. So what I considered was that I know that the day with the longest duration of sunlight happens on the summer solstice, which is about June 21st of each year. Our period of peak flowering in the Mid-South typically doesn't happen until roughly the 15th to the 20th of July. These two events aren't synchronized to my satisfaction. So we tried to get them closer into alignment here by planting cotton earlier than is normally done in the Mississippi Delta. And we did that. We set out a study where we compared planting during the first week in April with planting during the first week in May, which is when cotton is historically planted here in the Mississippi Delta. And lo and behold, we got about a 10% increase in yield by doing that. Most likely, this is probably not due to this better synchronization of the summer solstice with our peak flowering. Most likely, it's probably due to the avoidance of some of these late season stresses that can often crop up, such as increased insect infestation, exposure to drought stress, exposure to high temperature stress, things like this. Now, there are some drawbacks because we're not totally eliminating stress exposure by planting it. All we're doing is we're shifting one set of stresses, the late season stresses, for early season stresses, which are cold stress, obviously, exposure to possible seedling disease pressure here. I personally tend to think that these early season stresses may be a bit more manageable for us, but nevertheless, if you remember back to that initial challenge that I received from Bill Meredith to increase the yield of cotton by 10%, this is really my first offering up to that challenge to try to do that. In all our early studies with early planting, the only fiber quality trait that I saw that was altered was fiber elongation, which was decreased under early planting. Now, in the spirit of full disclosure, I do have to say that some of my later studies, we've got other fiber quality traits that have been altered, and since they would be viewed as possibly being negative consequences, I think I better mention them. In this later study, we found that fiber strength was decreased with early planting, and that fiber length, the 2% span length, was decreased with our early planting. We're also finding an increase in fiber micronair, principally due to the increase in fiber maturity. Again, this fits into our theory with early planting. We're probably going to have a little bit larger assimilate pool available for the reproductive growth. Okay, I'm going to skip on this since we're running a little behind here. What I wanted to do is I wanted to give some credit to the people who've helped me carry on this work over the years here, the support staff with it. Cedric Brown has been with me from day one through my studies. Tony Miller, he's been with me for about the past 15 years. William Noakes, Rex Manning, they are more or less like our farm managers for our plot land. They take care of everything in terms of actually growing the plants and plots and allow me to do a lot of the studies that I'm able to do. Jerry Gray is their chief right-hand man in taking care of the plants. I've had numerous summer employees over the years that have assisted with the data collection that I'm completely indebted to. And I'd also like to give credit to a lot of people that have collaborated with me over the years, both in research and in manuscript preparation here. Bill Meredith has been a joy to work with. I've learned so much from him, and it's been quite a pleasure. And if I have any time left, I'll try to entertain any questions.
We have time for one question.
Bobby.
You talked about early on about the differences in the somatic conductance and some of the things you showed.
Right.
Do you know, have any idea what the what differences there were in somatic density or anything like that?
Bobby, I took some stomal density numbers on those. You know, we took some photographs and then tried to count them over time. I don't remember there being a statistical difference between the leaf types at that time, but in all honesty, I can't say that I feel that comfortable about that data, you know, because some of the photographs were a little fuzzy, and I may have mistook something for a stomate that was just some other leaf. So while I had took some data, I really don't feel confident in saying that I picked out any differences among the leaf types for that. It may be there, just probably poor technique on my part.
Bill, congratulations again.
Thank you.
And thank you for being our keynote speaker today.
Yep. Vote for me.